or leaf or even a small stick, the firefinch was forming a shape.
A sigil,
Davood realized with growing wonder, for it looked somewhat like the sigil he had been studying these past many nights. It wasn't the same, though. There were many similarities, but the new sigil was also different in notable ways. Slowly it became clear. Within it, Davood saw flora. He saw mastery, but not decay. A new sigil had replaced it, easy to distinguish, for it was rendered using leaves instead of twigs or branches.
And what is this? Davood wondered.
He flipped to an empty page in Hamzakir's book. He drew the new sigil on its own first, then the combined sigil on the following page. He gave it no name, not knowing its nature, but he repeated the ritual he had tried earlier, first wiping away the blood on his palm, then drawing the new sigil with a fresh tap of blood. When he reached out to the fig tree again, he felt something different. Something more, much more. He saw the tree's seed as it was planted in a nursery, saw it grow until it was knee-high, saw it uprooted with intense discomfort, before being replanted here on the patio and surrounded by decorative stone coping. The tree grew. Days became weeks, became seasons. The passage of time felt like waves of heat and cold, of darkness and light, of the very breath of life, for he felt not only the tree itself, but also the living mites and beetles and caterpillars that crawled along its length, the birds nesting in its branches, the chicks hatching, the nestlings flying from the nest, far away from this lonely patio. Time slowed, and Davood realized he was nearing the end of his journey. He woke and took a deep breath, so deep it felt as if he could inhale the entirety of the desert. Rhea, he realized, had spanned the night sky. It was preparing to set in the west. He blinked away his disorientation.
What in the name of gods just happened?
Disorientation, he realized, not lethargy. He was more energized than he had been since those moments in Ishmantep, when he had commanded the fire away from the burning ship.
Gods, Davood thought, I was that tree.
With his own thoughts and memories returning to him, he looked around for the firefinch and saw that it was gone. He looked up into the tree but saw no birds of any kind. As he was heading back toward the table, he started. Two figures stood in the doorway, leading into the apartments. Anila with Bella, the granddaughter of Sukru's head chef, who was himself a distant relative of Sukru's. They were quite a pair. Bella, young, inquisitive and bright-eyed, Anila, with her glistening black skin, the thread of gold headscarf she used to hide her baldness, and eyes that seemed to weigh everything they came across. Anila was peering into the branches, but then her attention swiveled to the table where the sigil was still formed by the branches, where the book was still open to the freshly inked pages. Davood closed the book, then swept away the twigs and leaves. They tumbled to the patio stones. Holding the book, feeling his face burning red, Davood faced Anila.
How are you feeling?
Anila's eyes bored into his, unforgiving, questioning him more effectively than words ever could. Bella, sensing the tension, fidgeted as if waiting for Anila to say something.
Do you need anything? Davood asked.
Anila stared a moment longer. Wincing, she turned and limped awkwardly away. After sharing a quizzical look with Davood, Bella followed her. Davood took a moment to scatter the twigs even more, as if afraid the wind might push them back into the sigil's shape. Then he gathered his things and went inside. The following day, Davud wandered the palace. He strolled through the central gardens, climbed the library tower, and made his way to the great hall, which was filled with rare art, beautiful paintings, fine vases, golden plates. He lingered, enjoying himself, but kept an eye out for one particularly precocious girl. After a long and fruitless search, he found her by pure chance. He had given up and was heading back toward his room when he heard the sound of splashing. Of course. There was a small wading pool nearby. He walked through a scalloped archway and came to it. A large oval pool filled with the clearest water Davud had ever laid eyes on. Painted ceramic tiles lined the pool. Around it were flagstones made of pretty blue slate. In the pool, a handmaid was tending to a flock of children who ranged in age from toddlers, barely old enough to walk, to Bella, and a wide-eyed, black-haired boy who seemed roughly the same age. All wore simple white tunics, which clung to their skin as they splashed and kicked the water about. Davud waved to the young handmaid, who smiled back but quickly went after one of the young ones who was trying to go into the deeper water.
"Hello, Bella!"
Davud crouched near the edge of the pool. The ceramic bed was sloped so that the waves lapped softly at his feet. He went in until his leather sandals got wet, then leapt back, wrapping his arms around himself as if he shivered from head to foot. Bella laughed. He tried again, teeth chattering, making a show of touching one toe to the water.
"Why, it's cold as snow! How can you stand being in there?"
Bella laughed harder.
"It's warm, silly. You're just pretending."
Davud stepped back in carefully, closing his eyes and sighing loudly, as if the water were now warming his frigid feet.
"Anila told me this pool was magic, but I didn't believe her."
"She didn't either."
"She did."
Davud paused, as if he were debating on sharing a secret. He glanced at the handmaid, then stepped closer to Bella and crouched down.
"Anila is magic too, you know."
Bella nodded.
"She was burned by the fire, but she used her magic to make it out alive."
Davud decided not to correct her.
"Do the two of you speak often?"
She nodded again, this time so hard her pigtails shook.
"Almost every day."
"What about?"
Bella shrugged.
"My horse. I'm going to race her one day. Mama said I could."
"Does she ever talk about me?"
She lifted her foot high and stomped the water, making a plunk sound. The water flew high, splashing her and Davud both.
"Bella, does she ever talk about me?"
"No."
"Does she ever say what she wants to do?"
Bella waded through the water, arms wide, kicking it up into the air ahead of her, a parade of diamonds before a striding princess.
"She wants to learn."
"Learn what?"
Bella jumped in up to her neck, then came up dripping.
"Learn like she did in the collegia. She misses it."
"I do too, Anila," Davud thought.
"Bella,"
the handmaid was waving her over.
"Come dry yourself, it's time to eat."
Without another word, Bella turned and splashed hard through the deepest part of the pool to rejoin the other children. As Davud watched them go, he thought,
"How can a girl who's only just met Anila know more about her than I do?"
He knew the answer, of course.
She cared enough to ask.
As the handmaid herded the children from the water, Davud smiled sadly, then turned and left.
Chapter 11.
King Isan ran his finger up the page of Yusam's journal and started the passage again.
A storm rages above Toriat. No mundane storm. The clouds are struck through by light, striations of blue against charred marble. Goshen, god of chaos, works alone, twin tails lashing in his wake. He has climbed above the palaces, intent on reaching the mount's uneven top. He waits there, surveying the city below, the desert beyond. Charakai is largely whole, though fires burn along the western edges, and the war still rages in the southern harbor and deep in the merchant's quarter, threatening the city's porous inner walls. Tulathan follows Goshen. Her long, silver hair flows in her wake, not unlike the swaying of Goshen's tails. Her naked skin is tinged in blue, resplendent in storm-bred darkness. She reaches Goshen's side. The other gods approach. Golden Rhea, Thash, tall and stoic. Baki is intent upon the sky as Goshen, though with little of the dark god's anger. He is accepting somehow, and I wonder whether this is important. Yorinde is there as well. She has fallen on the slopes, unmoving, all but forgotten by the other gods. Her body lies unnaturally, one hand clutching her throat. That she died in pain is clear. Has she betrayed them in some way? Failed them? The gods gather. They take each other's hands. And they wait. This is where the vision ends. I am thrown from it, as I often am, by pain, which indicates that the mirror has shown me something that might be related to my own demise. Yet this differs from many previous visions. The city is not a wasteland, as the mirror has shown on a number of occasions. Does this mean the steps we've taken have helped us avoid the path of destruction we walked for many years? Time will tell. But I am hopeful. Yorinde's death and her position on the mount both concern me. Must she die? Is this what the vision has prescribed? In many previous visions, she became uncharacteristically aggressive, meddling in the lives of mortals, both in Charakai and the desert beyond. In the one, she even spoke directly to several of the kings, Kiral, Husamatin, Sukru and Kahil, all towards some greater purpose, it seemed to me. I felt certain I was coming close to finding that purpose, but now this, and I worry. I'll never know. And what of Nalame? Again and again I am foiled in my attempts to find her, to sense her path. I have long thought she has worked actively against me. Now I am certain of it. Since her last known rebirth 2 generations ago, my ability to see anything about the goddess has diminished, no doubt from her slow awakening to what has come before. Does her ability to hide affect mine to see the paths ahead? I must set aside the time to investigate further. If only there were some news of her. The sound of footsteps roused Isan from his reading. My lord king,
Tolovan, his tall vizier, spoke from the horseshoe archway nearby.
King Azad has arrived.
They both knew, of course, that King Azad was in fact Nyan, but Isan had always been careful to keep a strict code of keeping to appearances. Nyan was supposed to have been lost, after all, the same night Azad had been killed by Chader's mother, Aya.
Send him in, Isan said.
Tolovan bowed and left, returning shortly with King Azad. Uncharacteristically, Azad wore a flowing cloak over his rich robes, a Khmeri import.
A bit much, don't you think?
Isan asked as Tolovan left and Azad came to stand before the desk.
Kiral wanted me to meet with Queen Meriem, Azad shrugged. He asked that I humor her. I saw no reason to deny him.
And how is she, Khymer's new queen?
Well enough. It was a luncheon, though Kiral asked her to remain with him as the rest of us were dismissed.
Azad took a seat, stiff-backed, on one of the upholstered stools across from him.
Forgive me,
Isan said, remembering himself and waving Azad to take his padded chair. Though the body before him showed no signs of it, Nayan was carrying his child. That and Nayan's natural form had both been transformed through the magic of the necklace she wore. Azad stared at the chair crossly.
Please,
Isan said.
I need no pampering, my lord king.
It isn't pampering,
a half-truth.
I've asked you here so that you can read what I found.
Azad looked unconvinced, but he stood and came to sit in the large high-backed chair that not so long ago had belonged to King Yusam. Azad read over the passage Isan had been lingering over for several days now. That one and several others like it. When done, Azad pushed the journal away.
What of it? There are likely a dozen other accounts that contradict this entirely.
You're not mistaken. There are.
Isan paced before the wide table, his footsteps echoing.
I might have given you some more credit when he was alive. The things he saw would have driven me mad.
Azad paged through the journal, written over 40 years before.
They did drive him mad.
I don't think so.
Isan stopped his pacing to point to the marginalia. Dozens of notes penned in red or green ink, contrasting the ochre of the rest of the page. Isan pointed to one near the corner.
See here.
It was a note that referenced a date. The 208th year of the king's reign in Sharakai. 12th of Sindra. Tavandi. It was a reference to a particular day, a particular vision, in yet another of Yusam's endless journals. That very journal was on the desk, already open to the relevant page. He pulled it toward himself and pointed to the entry, which spoke of a specific attempt to find Nalame, which in turn referenced yet one more entry from a particularly strong vision Yusam had received over 100 years before. An account of Nalame being hunted and killed by Thash, the god of war. Azad read all three accounts, then leaned back in the chair, shaking his head.
It's dizzying.
Now imagine dealing with 4 centuries of it. It's a wonder he remembered to take his cock out before pissing.
Azad frowned at the analogy.
And you claim he wasn't mad?
My point is that while you, Sam, may have become lost in trying to deal...
He waved to the shelves upon shelves of journals that lined the walls around them.
With all of this... He did remember to take his cock out before pissing.
He pointed to the journal.
His memory for events was much better than I ever gave him credit for. Throughout these journals, he draws upon vision after vision, tying it all together, or ruling out certain predictions that, based on evidence, could never come to pass.
He hardly saw a thing toward the end.
True, but I don't think that was due to madness.
I think it was because he was nearing his own death.
Isan recited Yusam's bloody verse.
See far his eyes, through cloak and guise, consumed by sight is he. Yet as death nears, will grow his fears, still blinded shall he be.
Azad, who had heard it only once before, nodded.
So his abilities were diminished as he neared his death, unable to see his path forward, or others.
That about sums it up, yes. He was consumed by his fading power, and started to focus heavily upon it, trying to fool the gods, but lost sight of much else in the process.
I'm sure this is all fascinating, my king. But what is your point?
My point is that there is much here.
He waved again to the journals.
This is a grand resource I hope to use to navigate our way forward. Yours
and mine. There is Yusam's heir to consider.
Heir? He is a madman.
Yusam hadn't fathered a child in over 80 years. His one remaining child was presently locked in one of the towers of this very palace, a lunatic who thought himself the leader of a troop of minstrels. When he wasn't shitting himself, he was demanding to be taken to his tent, and for the troop's best jongleurs, his granddaughters, to be brought before him. That he had no sons or daughters, much less granddaughters, didn't seem to bother him.
Mad he may be, but there are already those who seek to use him to gain a seat at the table.
No one, least of all Kiral, will stand for it. They've all had enough, begging your pardon, of petulant children demanding to sit at the head table.
Any time such things were brought up during council, it understandably rubbed Azad the wrong way. The young King Alishan, on the other hand, Kulishan's son, was another matter entirely. He had been given the Wandering King's crown and his title, and now he was pressing for a say in matters of state. The young man had nearly lost himself his head the last time council had met, arguing with Kiral over the right to more of the city's coffers.
Hungry children or not, Azad went on. Trouble will come of it sooner or later.
Yusam's situation was the most easily dealt with. They couldn't allow his son, a barking basset of a man, to take his father's place. His descendants in Golden Hill would balk at it, trying to position themselves for more, or at least not less, than what they had become accustomed to. But in the end, Yusam's throne would remain empty. Onor's seat was a different matter. Here they had the opposite problem. The man had too many children, few of them legitimate, and many of those had been formally disowned. Onor was a jealous man, and had seized on any insult to withhold the inheritance of those he had sired. Fortunately for Isan, Onor was so spiteful, he often had his children stand before him as their proclamations of forfeiture were read. Those very same proclamations now provided Isan and the others all the leverage they needed to keep many of the claimants at bay. At the very least, he would ensure that their claims to Onor's crown would take years to sort out. It helped, certainly, that Onor had fled, which had given Isan time to craft and plant stories about his betrayal of Sharakai and its rightful rulers. It helped as well that Onor was active in the desert. It created fear and uncertainty in any wishing to sit the throne of the feasting king.
"We'll deal with them easily enough," Isan said. "We cannot afford to have more lords withholding their taxes from us." "Is it Bashir, the king of coin, who sits before me, or Azad, who has more to worry about than filling the city coffers?"
Azad frowned
and spoke carefully. I think you're underestimating just how dry the tinder is in Sharakai. We've been pushing too hard for too long. The city is ready to rise against us.
Man will put it to good use, but only when the time is right. In the meantime, Isan motioned to the journal before him, there are riddles to be answered.
Nalame? She's set to rise once more. What of it? The desert gods will likely kill her once more. That's exactly what troubles me. They've taken her life a dozen times since Betiman, perhaps more.
Why?
Because she betrayed them. She didn't heed Tulathan's call. She chose to remain away from the city while all the other gods met on Turiat.
Yes. And why was that?
Asad shrugged, looking over the account he had read a moment ago, only with more interest.
You have thoughts?
Nothing worth mentioning now, but this is why it's vital to take a true accounting of Yusam's writings.
And what will you do that Yusam could not?
Apply a fresh eye.
You're right that he was less reliable near the end. It may have led him to tie the wrong events together or overlook some simple connections.
Azad stood and shrugged.
Seems a waste of time.
No matter what we do with Sharakai, we would be unwise to forget the desert's true masters.
Tolovan ducked his head inside the room.
My lord kings, a message has arrived. King Zaheb wishes to see you both at his palace.
Impertinent, Azad said. Could he not have made the journey here?
Tolovan shook the rolled letter he held in his knuckly right hand.
The letter indicates it's to do with the men taken to his palace.
Prisoners, men of the Moonless Host, Isan knew, captured recently.
Have the coach prepared, Tolovan.
Chapter 12. In the dark of the night, with the moons casting long shadows over the city, Emre waited not far from the fighting pits. As dark as it was, he wasn't watching so much as listening, but he could see the open window of Tariq's home 3 stories up. He heard the crash of a door being kicked in, heard a woman scream, heard a scuffle, and the scream being cut off. Muffled words filtered into the night, Hamid giving orders to Darius and Frail Lamai. They were quiet enough, but they had moved beyond stealth, and Emre could hear them, searching the small home. Lamai had said he had seen Tariq pay a visit to Adzin's ship. Why? Many thought the old soothsayer a quack, a swindler. The fortunes he gave were often not well received. The man was too truthful for most. But Emre believed in his power. He'd seen it at work with his own eyes. Others in the host had as well, and Masid had grudgingly come to trust him. But that did nothing to explain Tariq on Adzin's ship. Osman was well known for despising such men.
Even if he can tell the future, he had once told Emre. Why would a man want it? Everyone knows the fates come calling for those who try to escape them, and when they do, it goes much worse than if they'd left well enough alone.
Tariq and Osman's role in this was simply to organize a ship, so why would Tariq have visited Azdin's sloop? For Osman's sake? Or his own? Perhaps, but the timing of his visit with Moonless Host's departure from the city was suspicious. Emre had to know the truth, and he was sure he could get it even if Tariq tried to lie. The two of them knew one another too well to hide much from the other for long. Emre caught movement along the rooftop. The silhouette of a slender man moving with speed. Limed in moonlight, he looked like Tulathan's servant. A thief sent to Sharakai to do her bidding. Emre was supposed to warn the others if he saw Tariq leaving, but he remained silent as Tariq glided onward, picking up speed as he neared the gap between his building and the next. He leapt from the roof's edge, spanning the alley before landing on a brick balcony with an acrobat's grace. Then he was climbing down, the darkness swallowing him, as he was lost to the moonlight. Emre's old instincts kicked in as he padded toward him. He moved with liquid ease, and yet Tariq still sensed him. He had always been the best of them at sensing danger. No sooner had his head swung toward Emre's position than he was leaping the last story and a half, dropping and rolling and coming up in a dead sprint. Emre was ready, though. He was running hard to intercept. Tariq tried to change tack. He stopped and went for his sword, but Emre closed the gap too quickly. He caught Tariq around the waist and brought him down like an oryx, being felled by a black laugher. Tariq grunted, rolling with the tackle, trying to throw Emre off. Emre caught an elbow across the jaw in the midst of it, but held tight.
"Stop fighting, Tariq, I only want to talk."
Tariq still struggled to get away, so Emre levered his weight over him, being careful not to let Tariq's shamshir clear its scabbard. Then he struck Tariq across the face.
"I said stop fighting! I'll release you, but you have to answer some questions." "I'd rather lick my own sack." "That can be arranged."
Emre lifted him, then drove him back down with everything he had.
"Hamid's on your trail too, and believe me, if he finds you, what happens next is out of my hands."
Silence followed. Tariq finally relaxed.
"I'm supposed to believe you're my bloody savior, then?" "I'm the one who decides whether you live to see the sunrise, Tariq. Now tell me why you betrayed the host." "I don't know what..."
Emre punched Tariq hard in the mouth.
"By now they'll be coming down the stairs, Tariq."
Tariq squirmed, reeling from the pain.
"I didn't betray the host."
Emre pulled back his arm to strike him again, and Tariq blurted,
"It was Pelham."
Pelham was Osman's second, who ran the pits on a day-to-day basis.
"Go on." "They took Osman, Emre. 5 of those bloody maidens walked right into his home in the dead of night and took him. A man came to the pits the next day, told Pelham that Osman would be returned and his businesses left intact as long as Pelham did what they said."
"When was this?"
"A week ago."
"Don't lie, Tariq."
"I'm not lying. It was a week ago today."
"I said, don't lie. A week ago, we hadn't even contacted Osman."
"They knew everything. They said you'd come, that you'd be desperate, that you'd ask for a way out of the city. They even said I had to deliver the message, and that you'd be the one to meet me."
A sliver of ice formed and grew inside of Emre.
"Me?"
"They said my oldest friend would meet me."
"But how?"
"How else? It must be the Jade-Eyed King."
"But he's dead. Everyone's saying so. You believe everything you hear on the streets now?"
Was it true then? Did Usam live? Or was this something he had passed on before he died?
"What does it matter?" Emre thought. "We're in for it now."
Emre heard Hamid calling for him.
"It's a trap,"
Emre whispered.
"They'll take every last person who shows up at that ship."
"Gods. Fucking gods. Masid and the rest. They're all going to die."
"I meant what I said, Emre. You could lie low a while. We can get past this."
Emre heard the others approaching. He pulled Tariq up to his feet.
You're the one who needs to lie low a while. I'm not afraid of Hamid. You should be. He's as savage as the Confessor King when his blood's up. And it will be when he hears this.
Emre, you can't help them anymore.
I need to try. Now hit me, quick.
Tariq just stood there, his eyes saucers in the darkness.
Do it, Tariq.
And then he did. He punched Emre across the right eye. It was a hard hit, but not as hard as it might have been. Emre fell, only an act, but he had to make it look good for the others. Tariq was gone in a flash, sprinting down a darkened alley as Hamid, Darius and Frau Lamai came running around the corner.
Where were you?
Darius asked.
I saw him escaping.
You were supposed to call,
Frau Lamai said, punching one hand into the other.
If I'd called, he would have escaped.
He did escape,
Hamid spat. Emre sent an ineffectual wave in the direction Tariq had run.
I thought I had the drop on him.
You weren't supposed to call,
Frau Lamai repeated. It was dark, but Emre could still see the great furrow in his brow, the one that came when he couldn't piece things together.
He let Tariq go, Lem,
Hamid said before Emre could reply.
Gods curse you, Emre. I knew I shouldn't have left you alone.
Me?
Emre cried.
I was the one who spotted him. I took him down while the three of you were holding your cocks upstairs.
Hamid strode forward and shoved Emre back so hard he fell to the street. Hamid's knife was out the next moment.
You decided to let your old friend go. The only thing I'm not sure about is why.
Hold on!
Emre shouted, scrabbling away.
Hold on! I know what to do!
He knew no such thing, but Hamid had that look in his eye.
Why did I let Tariq go?
Wait, Hamid,
Darius said, grabbing Hamid's sleeve. Hamid ripped his sleeve free.
Don't think to deny me, Darius.
He pointed the knife at Frau Lamai as well, who was walking forward with arms raised in a placating gesture, as if he hadn't seen Hamid fly into a murderous rage like this a half dozen times before. Hamid shoved the knife at Emre.
He betrayed us. I betrayed no one. He said he knew what to do,
Frau Lamai said. Hamid made a show of flourishing to Emre.
Well, then do go on, Emre. Tell us this brilliant plan of yours.
Frère Lamai shuffled his feet and wrung his hands. He always became this way when his friends fought.
Go on, Emre!
Emre had no earthly idea what to do. How could he possibly navigate the host to safety when the kings had stacked so much against them?
You see,
Hamid said, pointing at Emre with his knife. And then it came to him in a flash. But sunrise was near. Gods, the horizon was already beginning to brighten.
All of you, follow me.
He tried to run wide around Hamid, but Hamid imposed himself.
Where are you going? Adzin. We're going to Adzin. He's the one who betrayed us.
When Hamid remained still as a statue, Emre clasped his hands and shook them, pleading.
Quickly, Hamid. While we argue, the night is wasting away.
It took Hamid a moment. He looked to the others, then back at Emre. Then he slammed his knife into its sheath.
Better be right, Emre.
And then they were off, running for the western harbour. From the darkness of a tavern pergola, Emre, Hamid, Darius and Frau Lamai watched as the crew of a ramshackle sloop prepared to tow back from the pier and into the harbour. Lanterns cast a meagre golden glow over the rigging and deck of a ship that was in such disrepair it looked about to take its final voyage. 5 crewmen worked the tow ropes. At a call from a giant of a man, a dark-skinned Kunduni standing on the pier near the prow, the crew pulled the ropes taut and heaved while the Kunduni held the gunwale and used his legs to power the ship back along the pier. Tariq had come here to Ardzin, perhaps to offer him a bribe, perhaps to coerce him under threat of harm. Perhaps both. Ardzin had agreed, of that much Emre was certain. The ritual he had performed in front of Masid had likely all been for show, leading them to the answer the kings themselves had preordained. That Masid and the rest should embark on one particular ship the kings knew about, making it all too easy for them to intercept and either kill or capture them all. That wasn't what Emre cared about most, though. Explanations could come later. What he needed now were Ardzin's particular gifts, and this time Ardzin would either use them for real, or Emre would kill the man himself.
"Now," Emre whispered.
The 4 of them moved quickly across the quay and rushed down the pier like a pack of wolves, making sure to keep the stern of the ship between them and the men pulling at the tow ropes. The Kunduni straining along the gunwales heard them, but by the time he had turned, one of Frail Lamai's studded leather gloves was already rushing toward his jaw. He fell across the gunwales and was lost in a heap on the deck. The crew shouted. They dropped their ropes, most sprinting for the pier's ladder, a few heading toward the ropes hanging down over the stern. Emre and the others, meanwhile, rushed onto the ship and down into the open hatchway. Darius and Frail Lamai closed the hatch after them and barred it. Ahead of Emre and Hamid, golden light spilled from a cabin doorway, bathing a passageway lined with odd, grisly assortments nailed to the walls. Braided hair, babies' sandals, strings of blackened teeth, rusted iron forks with some lumpy brown residue coating the tines, a papyrus doll in the shape of a woman wearing a crown of thorns. Emre rushed past it all just as the cabin door ahead began to close. He charged and struck it like a battering ram. A thump and a high-pitched scream came from the opposite side just before he burst into the cabin. Ardzin lay on the carpeted floor, wincing and tenderly probing his forehead, where a gash was starting to well and drip a river of crimson. He stared at the blood on his fingers, then took in the looming forms of Emre and Hamid, with confusion and anger, and something else.
Resignation.
"Have I not given the host enough?" he said.
"You know," Emre said as he grabbed 2 fistfuls of Adzin's robe and hauled him to his feet.
"You'd think he would have seen this coming."
And then he punched Ardzin in the stomach. Ardzin doubled over, his breath wheezing from him in one long whoosh. For several long seconds, the sound of his aborted attempts at breathing filled the cabin. After one long, wet breath, he started coughing like a man in a losing battle against consumption.
"Who says I didn't?"
he managed. The crew had reached the hatch door. There were shouts and something hard crashed against it.
"No," Emre said. "You wouldn't have gone to all this trouble setting up the Moonless Host, only to have us track you down if you'd known." "That depends, doesn't it?" "On what?" "On the other choices, you bloody fool. On the other choices."
Hamid's face turned to stone, an indicator he had heard more than enough. He grabbed Ardzin and shoved him into the passageway, making a dozen things fall and clatter against the warped floorboards. Hamid pressed Ardzin's face onto the nails until Ardzin began screaming from it. Hamid yelled in his ear,
"Order your men to help us, or I'm going to gut you like a desert coney.
The pounding against the hatch came louder and something gave.
Enough!
Ardzin cried.
Ogzan! Sink! Let us be a while!
The pounding at the hatchway door stopped.
Ardzin?
I said let us be!
Good,
Emre said, then motioned to the low table in the cabin.
Bring him in here.
Hamid did, shoving Ardzin so hard he tumbled over the pillows and struck his head against the hull. As Ardzin righted himself and straightened his robes, Emre knelt and stared him in the eye.
Here's what happens next. We're taking your ship, Ardzin. And then you and your crew are going to help us free Masid and the others.
Ardzin swallowed, again with that strange look of his. This time Emre recognized it for what it was. There was resignation. But it wasn't anger or confusion that mixed with it. It was sorrow. Chapter 13.
I remember meeting you when I was young,
Jada said to Salsana, the woman who'd come in the skiff to rescue Chada and Karim from the tower. A glimmer of recognition had plagued Chada since they'd started their journey, but she'd only just remembered where they'd met that morning, when Salsana had woken early and practiced sword forms along the top of a dune. She was a tall woman with rust-coloured hair. She was muscular, the small scars she sported somehow complementing the blue tattoos on her chin and cheeks and forehead. She was beautiful in the way ebon blades were beautiful, in the way the curve of a perfectly balanced spear was beautiful. Salsana, choosing not to reply, adjusted the tiller to take a steep rise along a dune more easily. They were sailing west, and had been for 3 days now. Ahead, tall and imposing, were the Taloran Mountains. The ground had become steadily more treacherous as they'd neared the foothills, which loomed not so far ahead. Rocky surfaces were becoming difficult to avoid, forcing them to occasionally sail over them, and the small red boulders that littered the ground had become massive and much more numerous. Chada grew annoyed by Salsana's silence.
You watched me while my mother spoke with Leora.
Chada didn't know it when they had first met, but Leora was Chada's great-grandmother, the mother of Ishak, leader of the Moonless Host.
Watched you fumble your way around your sword more like.
She said it with a humorless smile, glancing at River's daughter with a look like she had caught something unpleasant between her teeth. She had been doing so over the course of their journey, and always with a similar look of distrust, even of anger.
I was six.
Chada still remembered how intimidated she had been. Then, as now, Salsana had projected an intensity no one could fail to recognize. Salsana shrugged.
It was clear how well you would take to the sword.
Oh, this?
Chada put her hand on the pommel of River's daughter. Would you like to see it?
Why would I wish to see a blade that has tasted the blood of my people?
Because you seem to be spellbound by it. Perhaps it will help you understand that I was trained in the House of Maidens, that while I obeyed some of the king's orders, I also sought to bring them down.
Did you?
She pulled the skiff easily around a standing stone.
Seek to bring them down.
2 kings have fallen to this blade.
Salsana sneered.
You doubt me.
The wandering king died when he succumbed to Adhikara blooms. Hardly a wondrous victory. And the jackal king Masut died on the night of endless swords. Who's to say you had a hand in it, especially since you fled?
The Confessor King witnessed Mesut's death.
as did the gods themselves. Salsana snorted.
As you see.
Jada grinned while nestling herself into the prow, her arms resting along the gunwales. If you wish to test my skill, you need but ask. Salsana eyed River's daughter again, then Misut's golden band on her wrist. She looked about to speak, but was interrupted by Karim, who lay in the skiff's bottom. He stirred, and Salsana looked at him with naked revulsion. Jade ignored her and knelt beside Karim.
Are you well?
Karim managed with great effort to lift his gaze and look at her.
Honor's presence is lifting at last.
Her head jerked back involuntarily. Karim hadn't spoken to her in this way since she'd left with Beryl to join Tribe Selmuk. Indeed, she could feel his anger once more, his misery, the love for his mother whose memory had been rekindled as Chayda had talked about her own.
Rest, she bade him. Soon we'll be in the mountains.
To her surprise, his heart lifted.
Have you ever been?
She asked him.
Never.
His eyes blinked. Tears slipped from them. And then he said aloud,
I'd always hoped to.
Salsana started, ready to draw her blade at the mere hint of movement from Karim. She stared at him with annoyance, but said nothing as they sailed on. Soon they were crossing patches of stone regularly. The scraping sound of the skis made Chayda wince. It reminded her of her mother, Aya, who had had much the same reaction when Chayda had scuffed the skis. It reminded her of Jaga as well, her old mentor in the pits, from whom Chayda had borrowed skiffs from time to time, fouling them more often than she had meant to. Jaga was furious when she did, but she always let Chayda take a skiff when she needed it. The way opened up after hours of Salsana's careful navigation. The rocks became fewer, and then suddenly they were on open sand once more. It was a natural place for the host to hide, Chayda reckoned. Most larger ships would grind to a halt before they reached this area of open sand, and their hulls and masts would be masked by the standing stones. Near nightfall, they came to a grotto, where Salsana anchored, and Chayda carried Karim to a good place to build a fire. She had no sooner set Karim down, however, than she found Salsana with her sword out, the tip wavering beneath Chayda's chin.
What are you doing?
Chayda asked.
I've thought on it, and I do wish to test your mettle.
You're acting like a child.
On the contrary. I take great care over the welfare of the Moonless Host, and in you, I sense only lies.
You are your people's judge, then.
You'll know the truth of my words at the very crossing of our blades. I'll know if you've told the truth about your skill with the sword, and that alone will tell me much about you.
Chayda's hand was hurting, she realized. The poison wound on her thumb flaring up. She rubbed it, feeling the familiar pain, feeling her anger rise as well. When Salsana took one more step and slashed with the speed and force of a woman who meant to draw blood, Chayda drew River's daughter in one swift motion and blocked the blow. There was no crossing of blades, as they'd done when she was young. This was a pissing match. Plain and simple, but she had had enough of Salsana's smug looks, her questioning stares. When they were young, Salsana had taught her about anger and not letting it get away from you. It was time for Chayda to return the favor. She went on the offensive, and the two of them flew over the sand, their breath rising. Salsana blocked blow after blow, riposting with an eagerness that reminded Chayda of Camille. Though Salsana was nowhere near Camille's match, and Camille had taught Chayda well. So had Sumeya and Melisse and Zaid. Chaedah felt Salsanna reaching for her heart as Blade Maidens did. Salsanna had some skill, but after all of Chaedah's training with Zaid and the months of practice using the ways of the heart as a servant of the king's, it was child's play to sidestep Salsanna's attempts at gaining an advantage. It angered Salsanna. She pressed with a dangerous fervor. Her lips drew back to reveal clamped teeth. Her eyes widened, and her swings turned wild. Chaedah blocked everything Salsanna threw at her, planning to simply let her fury expend itself. When it finally had, Chaedah would disarm her, and this foolishness would come to an end. Only a few breaths later, however, a dark form galloped in from her left.
Karim! No!
Chaedah tried to intercept him, but it was too late. Karim was on Salsanna in a blur of dark movement before she could raise her defenses against him. She was thrown sideways, the sand spraying where the two of them fell. Karim's arms rose and fell, long nails slashing. Salsanna screamed in pain as she tried but failed to ward off his powerful blows. Chaedah tried to pull him away, but he was too strong.
Stop it, Karim! You're going to kill her!
It wasn't until she felt his heart beating, with a pace like the swells of a ship on a windswept voyage, that his movements began to slow.
Return to me, she urged, daring to grip his arms once more.
The pain in her right hand flared terribly, but she ignored it, slowing her breath, bringing herself in sync with Karim's rhythm.
There's no sense in this. She is blood of our blood.
Finally, Karim obeyed. He stood above Salsanna, chest heaving, eyes filled with rage. But he allowed himself to be pulled away. With a long, warbling howl, he loped into the desert. Chaedah dropped to Salsanna's side.
Leave me!
Salsanna shouted, but Chaedah ignored her, quickly tearing away her sleeves to survey the damage. There were a dozen deep gashes along her arms and shoulders, lighter ones along her face and chest.
Set aside your pride, Chaedah said as Salsanna tried to push her away. If we don't get these stitched, you're going to bleed to death.
After several deep swallows, Salsanna allowed herself to be led to the fire. Chaedah bound the worst of her wounds with torn strips of cloth from Salsanna's sleeves, then raided the supplies in the skiff. After giving Salsanna a small ball of fermented black lotus to put between her cheek and gum, she stoked the fire, boiled thread in red wine, and stitched the worst of the wounds. When done, she bound the wounds in fresh bandages. Stoic through it all, Salsanna never cried out, never so much as whimpered. Instead, she stared at Chaedah with a look of regret that was mixed with a certain arrogance that kept her, perhaps, from voicing what both of them knew, that their duel had been beyond foolishness.
"Why does he follow you?"
Salsanna asked, her eyelids growing heavy from the effects of the lotus. Chaedah laid out blankets for Salsanna to sleep on.
"Because he knows I'm ready to help his people."
"Our people,"
Salsanna said as Chaedah laid her gently down. "Yes, but you can hardly compare what you and I have gone through with what they have. He and his brothers and sisters. Bet Iman is a burden we will never understand." As Chaedah sat cross-legged on the sand opposite the fire, Salsanna met her eyes. For a long while, Salsanna said nothing but then nodded.
"You're right."
She stared up at the cascade of stars, spilling across the indigo sky.
"I was born in tribe Rafik, one of the Biting Shields. I fought the Asirim, and the Asirim fought us, hounded us, took down several of our ships. For infringements of royal decree, our sheikh was later told.
The maidens killed my father for refusing to bend his knee when one of our ships was stopped. Then one of the Asirim killed two of my cousins, who were enraged by my father's death. She fell silent, and Chayda thought she'd fallen asleep. But a while later